What's up, Stitches? Welcome to the second So What episode of 2024. You are here with me, Isabella Rosner, and today we are going to go on a rousing journey through naval embroidery and embroidery tied to the sea. Thanks to Assistant Curator of Art at the National Maritime Museum, Maya Wassel Smith. This episode is an interview with Maya about the embroidery in the collections of the Royal Museum's Greenwich and the exciting new rehang of the Queen's House, which features a whole slew of textiles. I truly had no idea that the Royal Museum's Greenwich here in London had any embroidery, but it turns out that they have loads of pieces related to seafaring and everything that comes with it. I hope that you're as hyped to learn about it as I am, and I was, and I still am. Before we dive in, let me tell you about how you can see images of what we discuss in today's episode. If you've been here for a while, you know the drill, but if you're new, welcome. I'm going to tell you some things. You can see everything you need and more on the So What social media pages on Instagram, Twitter, and Facebook. Search So What, SEWWHAT, and you will find us. We also have a website, which is sowhatpodcast.com. As I mentioned like one hot minute ago, today's episode is an interview with Maya Wassel Smith. Maya is a collaborative doctoral candidate at National Maritime Museum and Cardiff University, researching sailor art maritime making in the long 19th century. She has engaged with, researched, and theorized objects within academia while studying history of design and material culture at the University of Brighton, and through curatorial and collections management work in museums. This has included London Borough of Newham Collections, Leeds Museums and Art Galleries, and Brunel's SS Great Britain, among others. Her broad research interests center on material culture and its connection to sociocultural, vocational, and industrial histories, including emotional objects, materiality, and gender. Maya is on this podcast today not only because I've never done an episode on embroidery and the sea or anything even like it, but also because the Queen's House, which is one of the historical properties that's part of the Royal Museum's Greenwich, has reopened this month being March 2024, after a rehang. The rehang includes a new exhibition which explores how Georgian fashions engaged with naval culture, which feels like right up the alley of lots of So What listeners, so I hope you enjoy. The Queen's House is a formal royal residence built between 1616 and 1635, and I cannot wait to go see the new rehang and bask in all of the building's 17th century glory. Okay, just a few little factoids, little things to tell you before we start the interview. One, my sound quality is not great in the interview. It sounds a bit like I'm down in a well, and I am very sorry about that. I've just moved flats and am trying to figure out where the right place is to record my fun little interviews, but clearly it's not going super well thus far. Luckily for all of us, though, Maya sounds great, and that is the important part because she's the one you really want to hear from today. Maya mentions the term carte de visite several times in our conversation. A carte de visite is a small photograph mounted on a piece of card, which was very popular from the mid-1850s onwards, all the way through the 19th century. And she also mentions Joseph McBryn's book. This book is Queering the Subversive Stitch, which is a really great book that I've mentioned several times on this here podcast. Okay, now that I've said my bits, let's get into the interview. Maya, thank you so much for being here today. I had no idea that the Royal Museum's Greenwich had so many pieces of embroidery, so I am genuinely hyped.
Yes. Yeah, we've got a cool selection.
What sorts of embroidery are in the collection of the Royal Museum's Greenwich? And I want to know kind of the variety of stuff, if you have any information about how these pieces got to the museum. I just want to hear everything.
Sure. It's funny because like textiles, needlework has never kind of in and of itself been a collecting priority for the museum. Mm. But you know, nonetheless, the museum has amassed this kind of, you know, quite interesting and exciting collection. Historically, the kind of collecting policy of the museum was Britain's kind of maritime history and endeavor. So, you know, in the periods in which they were collecting from that perspective, there were often pieces of needlework that came in that were associated with kind of notable naval figures, for example. Mm. And yeah, I mean, unsurprisingly, we have quite a few pieces of needlework associated with Horatio Nelson. Yes. One of them is this embroidered fragment of kind of a dress flounce, which is, yes, embroidered in like kind of acorns and oak leaves, which is, you know, symbolic of the Royal Navy and hearts of oak and all of that stuff, but is also embroidered with the names of his, like, his title. So the point at which he was given the Dukedom of Bronte, there was this big gala held to celebrate that and also celebrate the victory of the Battle of the Nile, and this was held in Sicily, so, you know, a real cool party. And the dress on which this embroidery exists was worn by Emma Hamilton, his partner, you know, kind of
that's wild,
yeah, saucy affair partner. Yeah, so, you know, there's those kind of quite spectacular, very special pieces. But we've also got this selection of samplers kind of at the other end of the kind of social political spectrum, made by, you know, women, girls, particularly, who weren't connected to Nelson, which, you know, like, celebrate, comment on his career, and then, you know, mourn his death. So one of them is embroidered by a 14-year-old called Mary Gill, and she lives in Dudley, so, you know, not particularly near the sea. And she makes this embroidery that has, you know, a memorial monument, a kind of tombstone of Nelson. But she's making it kind of 3 years after he dies. So, you know, it kind of shows, you know, the political engagement of these young women, these kind of, you know, ordinary girls, and, you know, the strength of feeling and the kind of public mourning when he died, like, even several years later. But, you know, kind of thinking about how the collecting policy of the museum has shifted, you know, in recent years, it's been revised, and, you know, now we try and reflect a wider range of human experiences of the ocean, kind of less kind of specifically naval, and so the kind of embroideries associated with that period are, or, you know, the current period are artistic responses to seafaring, so, you know, sailors' craft work, but also works that relate kind of more to themes like migration. And we have this really amazing, powerful needlework by an artist called Rachel Romeo. And it came out of a period in which she was, like, very actively campaigning on behalf of her father, who was at risk of deportation by the Home Office because of the Windrush scandal. And she was, in fact, a founder member of the group Windrush Action. And, you know, this embroidery is a paragraph of embroidered text in the shape of London. And it's this, you know, diatribe against the treatment of her father. But it kind of also reflects upon broader issues of identity, belonging, and like the experience of racism. And yeah, just, you're such a powerful piece. And in thinking about those themes, I think it's important to acknowledge that because of the museum's association with the Royal Navy, that there are examples of needlework in our collections which are bound up with Britain's colonial and imperial activity. An example of this would be a parasol that was donated to the museum's predecessor by Queen Victoria, and that was likely looted or taken as a battle souvenir during the Second China War. We also have a large selection of flags, you know, many of which have these kind of embroidered elements on them, or a kind of appliqued or have, you know, these amazingly delicate repairs. And they were, you know, often taken from ships captured in naval battles. But I think, you know, some of the embroideries in the World Cultures Collection are kind of offer a slightly more nuanced view of the kind of contact, I suppose, and exemplify the kind of, you know, back and forth trading between mm-hmm. naval personnel, settlers, travellers, you know, and indigenous communities. We have a small collection of First Nations Cree Métis quill work, for example. We've got some moccasins, we've got shot pouches, and they were bequeathed by descendants of Admiral George Back, and he, you know, likely commissioned and purchased them while he was traveling in North America and Canada. In fact, one of them is embroidered with his initials, which, you know, were likely kind of copied from a traveling case or something. So I think, you know, they exemplify quite an interesting, you know, creative kind of back and forth. Or, you know, I'm not sure if you'd go so far as to say a collaboration, but certainly a back and forth. Over the past few years, we've been working with the originating community of those objects. And, you know, the museum's learnt so much about their cultural significance, you know, thinking about them not just as objects of decorative art, but actually, you know, for the originating community, these are, you know, ancestors in and of themselves. Mm-hmm. But we've also learned that, you know, the pieces that we have are particularly fine examples of quill work, you know, potentially, you know, I think, you know, they're really like the epitome of the practice, you know, a practice which is being revitalized. And, you know, I think we've also learned that access to those objects is so important for these kind of revitalization efforts. In 2021, my colleagues ran a kind of digital viewing session where First Nations makers were able to direct a microscope which was attached to a camera so they could see kind of areas of the work and like techniques that they were using, and really access the pieces that were like really useful to their own practice. So
That's really cool.
It's really cool, right?
It's amazing how much ground the embroidery collection within the museum covers. I was going to say I didn't expect it, but I should have expected it, because like embroidery, textiles more generally, and kind of seafaring and global migration of goods and people, those are all very interconnected things. So it shouldn't surprise me that you have quite a lot of embroidery, because you have everything from the materials and products of embroidery to embroidery about the people who were at sea and everything in between. I like that the collection seems to cover so many different kind of contrasting elements of embroidery. You have the anonymous makers, you know, the anonymous First Nations makers who used porcupine quills to make this quill work embroidery. But then we have totally the opposite of that. We have Mary Gill, who's making an embroidery about Horatio Nelson. We know not only who she was, but also who she was depicting. So we have anonymity and kind of celebrity. We have all sorts of materials. We have, yes, this very violent connection between textiles and the sea, and then the slightly more messy connection between migration and power. Ooh, it's all here. It's all there. I'm going to ask the next question. There's like an actual specific reason you're here, right? And it's that the Queen's House, which is part of the Royal Museums Greenwich, is reopening this month, March, I was going to say 2023. No, March 2024. That's the year we're in. And it's reopening after a rehang of the permanent displays. And this rehang will include a new exhibition that explores Georgian fashions that engaged with naval culture. I'm very excited about that. So can you tell these lovely So What listeners more about what sorts of objects are going to be on display?
Yeah, of course.
Thanks.
So yeah, as you were saying, the Naval Fashions display explores kind of naval themes, naval motifs in fashion, kind of in and around the period of the Revolutionary and Napoleonic Wars. In terms of the objects, you know, they're potentially more textile related than they are embroidery, but
it's all connected, it's all relevant.
Yeah, exactly. It's been an amazing kind of jumping off point to talk about our embroidery. So yes, we've got fans and handkerchiefs, and you know, those are printed with this kind of quite detailed maritime information. So we have kind of compendia of flags and the kind of maritime flags of various trading and you know, other nations of the period, which is like, you know, quite fast moving political information at this period. There are also diagrams of naval battles and kind of maneuvers. What else have we got?
We've got pictures covered in like naval maneuvers. That'd be so funny. Go to the party like with your handkerchief of naval maneuvers, and everybody's asking. Like, that's like, I just imagine going to like a cocktail party and being like, "Hey, look at my new scarf, everybody!" and talking to people about naval maneuvers.
But like, yeah, I think, but that's like the, you know, that's kind of what we're trying to get at, because you know, particularly, well, you know, since the redevelopment of the Queen's House in 2016, we've been trying to kind of increase the presence of women in the house. So nice. You know, some of that is trying to find and display more works by women artists or which depict female sitters. So you know, one of the things that is going on display in the rehang is the museum's first portrait of a serving female naval officer.
That was like
an exciting new acquisition. But you know, because of the kind of male-centric nature of the Navy and maritime industries and how they presented themselves in art and in the decorative arts, you know, it's not necessarily always easy to do that female artist, female sitter work. And so, you know, one of the other ways that we've been trying to bring in women and women's experiences is looking at the objects that they are using, that they are consuming, to think about how they're engaging with the Royal Navy, you know, Britain's kind of maritime imperial activities, or the sea in general. And, you know, the fan, I think, is a particularly good example of it, because it kind of disrupts your expectations of what a fan is. You know, they're seen as these kind of fun, frivolous objects, you know, potentially even a little bit flirty if you're like flapping it around your face. But actually, we've got this, like, you know, such minutely detailed technical information on them about naval maneuvers, current events, international relations. And you know, it just really makes you rethink what sort of conversations are going on at the kind of balls and parties that one took a fan to. You know, these aren't women kind of sitting around talking about kind of silly things, gossiping. They're having these like really intense kind of political conversations. So yeah, that's, you know, that's part of the work that this display is doing. But I think, you know, it's also, we also wanted to show that, you know, the, that women engaging in fashion that celebrated naval achievements or had a kind of naval engagement with them, you know, wasn't always without risk. And so we also have like satirical prints. So we have one that incorporates the kind of coiffure a la Belle Poule, you know, the like Ancien Régime women wearing ship models in their hair.
Love it.
There's quite a famous print called Dresses a la Nile, where one of the women, there's a, these kind of fashion victims. One of them is wearing this dress that looks like an Egyptian mummy, and one of them's wearing like crocodile shoes. kind of they're both celebrating Nelson's victory at the Nile in 1805. But you know, these caricatures are, you know, aping people who, mainly women, who were engaging with the Navy in this way. So you know, it's women's interest in naval politics, it was often kind of ridiculed, or, you know, they were drawing vitriol for these kind of displays or engagements.
I find this so interesting, and I actually really appreciate what I'm learning from you, because I think I can't help but think quite a lot about girlhood engagement with ships and seafaring at the same time in the early 19th century, because there are a lot of samplers and a lot of silkwork pictures from this period made by preteen and teenaged girls that have ships on them, or there are women looking very distressed as they're watching a shipwreck worked in these very delicate silk threads. But I hadn't considered how those images not only have the capacity to reflect a girl's lived experience in terms of if she lives near the sea and she's seeing these ships, but also how it's kind of training them for a life in which they would be at a party or at the ball or in the, you know, the parlor or whatever with a fan that has these very intricate kind of layouts of what's happening in the world of the sea and naval battles. I hadn't put girlhood and the connection between girlhood and sea imagery together with this larger world of women engaging with the sea and the Navy. So thank you.
Oh, yeah. I'm loving it. I think the other thing is they're just like, I don't think the degree of like naval feeling in the early 19th century, just like within the popular culture, could be overstated. Like it was like absolutely saturated in it. And I think, you know, it shows that, you know, children are sponges drawing up the popular culture of the day. And, you know, that's they're expressing it.
Tell me about your favorite pieces. I'm going to make it plural to give you a nicer time. Favorite pieces of embroidery in the RMG collection, and what stories do they tell?
My PhD is on sailors' craft work. So, you know, unsurprisingly, I will have to say that, you know, examples of needlework made by sailors, you know, made by seafarers are my favorite. And, you know, sailors were like proficient sewers. You know, they had, you know, a lot of skills in that department. And they made all sorts of things. So, you know, we have embroidered handkerchiefs, we have cushion covers, we have this like wonderful pair of wall pockets, which is decorated with drawn thread work. So yeah, needlework. Yeah, I suppose it's needlework, isn't it? Drawn thread work.
Yeah, definitely.
But what they're best known for is Berlin wool works. And the museum has a really significant collection. As I'm sure your listeners already know, because they're listening to this podcast, Berlin woolwork refers to, you know, mostly pictorial embroideries. They're made using wool first imported from Germany, but then produced in the UK, and often using kind of commercially printed designs. So in a similar way to like cross stitch or something now. And there was, you know, this real craze for Berlin woolwork embroidery beginning in the 19th century, but like carrying on all the way through. You know, there were like emporia where you could go, and they were like just dedicated to Berlin wool work. So you could like choose from this enormous selection of colored threads, you know, particularly so after the 1850s when synthetic dyes start to come in. You know, they're in a wide range of colors. You can like pick from different designs. So, you know, it's absolutely the most popular form of craft work, and it brings in this kind of democratization of needlework, because, you know, investment in terms of material, in terms of skill, in terms of time are significantly lower in Berlin woolwork than kind of other forms of historic embroidery, of which you are the expert.
No, but you're right. Like, it does become much easier. All you need to know is one or two stitches.
Yes,
and the materials
exactly.
are cheap. Yeah.
And it grows quickly. You know, it's quite a thick wool. So you can build something quickly. You know, you get a real sense of return on your investment. And, you know, if you have limited leisure time, yeah. So I think it kind of starts off with the middle classes, but then, you know, it's really taken up by the working classes too. And, you know, sailors are certainly part of that. And, you know, with these newly kind of cheaply available materials, they bought Berlin will work into their existing craft practice.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, as I say, they already had embroidery skills, they had plain sewing skills. You know, this was like making, amending their own clothing, embroidering their names into their clothes, fixing sails, etc., etc. And they also have an existing like decorative art culture, so things like tattooing, scrimshaw, carving, and so they adapt Berlin wool work to their kind of creative needs and their own circumstances. Instead of following the kind of commercially produced patterns, often they make their own, and, you know, potentially unsurprisingly, the most common designs are ship's portraits, followed closely by the kind of trophy of flags design. The museum has a significant collection, and one of the things that makes it so great to work with is that unusually they have named makers. So most of the woolworks in our collection, yeah, totally, have, you know, a named maker, a sailor that we can research, which allows us to kind of perform these closer analyses of how making and needlework practice, you know, fit into their lives, fit into their careers, fit into their relationships. I'm looking at two examples at the moment of woolworks that we can date quite specifically. And they were both made when men had just signed up to the Navy. They were in training, on training ships, you know, thinking again about like childhood and boyhood. Yeah, exactly.
Yeah.
You know, these two designs are both the trophy of flag designs. So we have this kind of very grand selection of flags representing kind of commercial and military allies of Great Britain, but also often like quite a random selection of nations and maritime flags. And one of them, they surround a kind of carte de visite photograph of the maker. And on the other one, it's like
That's
a little,
cute.
Yeah. The other one is like a little, miniature ship portrait. The kind of work that I've been doing over the last few weeks is thinking about why they chose to embroider those designs at like this particular part of life, particular time. And, you know, there's something in there about this kind of mastery of the nautical language of flags, like they're developing these skills and they want to show them off. And yeah, I think that there's something in that, but I think there's also something in this it being quite an anxious stage of life. You know, they're away from home for the first time, you know, being in this new and, you know, quite harsh, regimented, scheduled environment. You know, one of them is actually made as a gift for the boy's fiance. So, you know, he's like making it to try and hang on to and maintain this relationship while he's on this training ship away from home. And yet these men are, or boys are, embroidering these like extremely jingoistic, you know, confident, even hubristic, imperialist designs. You know, it feels like such a kind of disconnect. But yeah, I mean, it's my thoughts on it aren't fully formed yet, but it's such an interesting Yeah, it's such an interesting example. Yeah, those are my favorite examples at the moment.
This is a very optimistic view of this, but it kind of feels to me like these boys are seeking a sense of belonging. They're envisioning, they're idealizing what their future life will be. Oh, I'm a sailor, like I'm part of this world, this community. Here are all the flags. Here's what this ship looks like. They are, I don't know, it kind of feels like they're setting themselves up for a life in which they are a capital S sailor, and that they are, this is their life now, and this is the world in which they live. Also, this is really interesting. I haven't talked about it on this podcast, though I have talked about Sailor Woolworks, which are also called Woolies, and I love that because I think they're so cute. I've been thinking a lot about how we in the present can look at needlework of the past through stitches and kind of understand maybe something about the maker or the type of work through the physicality of stitch, even though the maker probably was not like, I'm using this stitch and that's what this means.
Yeah.
But what does it mean for us to look at that? And I think a lot about these Sailor Wool works and how at a certain point they really move away from that kind of like very regimented cross stitch and tent stitch, these small diagonal stitches, into kind of like these long piece, like these long satin stitches that span oftentimes the length of these really big canvases, and they're covering these canvases with this very brightly colored thick wool thread. And I can't help but feel that there's a kind of connection, a parallel between the length of these stitches that dot from one side of a canvas to another and kind of the length of the seafaring journey that these men are gone for years at a time. And what does it mean to start here and end up all the way over here?
Yeah.
They were not thinking like that, almost certainly, but that's what I'm thinking.
Yeah, I think, I mean, one of the things that always fascinates me about the Woolworks is the creativity in which they invested what is often quite a formulaic object. So like, as I say, like so many of them are ship's portraits, you know, if you've seen one ship's portrait, you've seen, you know, thousands of others. But actually, when you start looking at them, you know, the way that they're depicting ships differs, and that's interesting. But like the main thing is the sea and the sky, and these men who, like, let's face it, are just looking at sea and sky for an enormous amount of their careers, are, you know, finding these like really fascinating and intricate and like beautiful, you know, dare I say it as an art historian, ways of depicting like wave movements or weather and wind and cloud formations. And, you know, often that's in either using different types of stitch or just, you know, like gradiating between different colors. Or yeah, I think, as you were saying, sometimes the stitch work is so simplistic, but the way that they're employing it becomes, can often be quite complex in what they're depicting.
How did they come to the museum? Has it been purchases, donations, a mix?
They have come in a variety of ways. A lot of them are donations by children or descendants who are like, these were made by my father, grandfather. So a lot of them have come in that way, and sometimes that is where the information comes through about, you know, how and why they made it. So the example that I gave earlier about someone making it for their fiance as a birthday present, that's in our museum documentation.
Love it.
But then more recently we've made some acquisitions. So there was one that we bought a few years ago now, which depicts, it's quite an unusual one because it's just an image, it's like a land-based image, and it's of the Mustafa Pasha barracks in Alexandria. And it has like a cute little donkey walking past the barracks. But, you know, also made after the bombardment of Alexandria, so, you know, again, like one of the interesting things about the Woolworks is that they're these like decorative, you know, sometimes poignant, but sometimes quite fun objects, but associated with really violent conflict. But the really interesting thing about the Mustafa Pasha wool work is that it has a carte de visite, as many of them do, but there's kind of the barracks depicted in the top half, and then there's a line of like zigzag stitching, and then underneath is like a brown wool work, back, like, you know, a brown ground of stitches, quite, you know, as you say, like long and short satin stitch. And then like floral kind of flowers and floral decoration. But the way that it's divided in two, and the way that the carte de visite is situated in the bottom half, it almost feels like a memorial, like the kind of pieces under the ground. I mean, with that one, we don't really know that much about we don't know anything about the maker or the context, other than kind of associating it with, we can trace the photo studio that the carte de visite is taken in, and that's also in Alexandria, and we can like plot out that on the map in relation to the barracks, and, you know, in relation to the port and stuff, so we can kind of figure out the journey of the maker and you know, the like local experiences that they were having, but we don't know anything else. So, you know, all of the stuff about whether it's a memorial piece, yeah, we can't, you know, that's all conjecture, but they're such fascinating objects. And yeah, it's not necessarily always up to me, but I hope that we'll acquire more in the future.
How intriguing. That piece sounds amazing. They all sound amazing, and you are very right. And I appreciate you for reminding us that even though these pieces often look, I don't know, kind of gentle and kind of inspiring in their large size, that they are tied to immense violence and subjugation and imperialism. Mm. And that even though you are looking at what looks to be like a, you know, kind of a calm sea and a beautiful ship, that this ship actually represents pretty bad stuff sometimes.
Yeah.
Most of the time.
Yeah.
Important to remember. Okay. Now I have to ask my favorite question, because I don't have to answer it because it's such a difficult one. What is your favorite piece of embroidery? Pieces. Yeah. If you need multiple ones, that's fine.
Rather than picking an embroidered object, I think I might pick an artwork of someone doing embroidery.
Yeah!
So I think you'll be familiar with it, but there's an engraving which was used as a frontispiece in the temperance newspaper, The British Workman. And it's, you know, one of the very few images that we have of a Royal Naval seaman sat on a gun deck with an embroidery frame, you know, making a wool work picture. It's used on the cover of Joseph McBryn's book. It's, you know, a really amazing image. But the thing that makes it my favorite is that that image has taken me on this like really amazing research journey over the last few years.
Take me on with you, I'm keen.
Yeah, let me tell you a story.
Yeah.
I came across the image during one of the lockdowns. I think actually potentially when Joseph McBryn's book was like announced and launched online. And, you know, I was so taken with it, so amazing. And I was like digging through all of these digitized holdings of the British Workman. And as I was going through it, I found a letter written a few months later, where the, I think, superior officer of the person who is depicted in the image is named. And it says that, you know, this man is stationed at X and X Coast Guard port, that he has this wool work, the one that's depicted in the image, but also other wool works that he is happy to kind of show people if readers want to come and visit. And I was like, this is great. I should say the other funny thing about the image is the needlework that the sailor is making, the design is taken from another British workman frontispiece. And I, when I first saw the image, I was like, yeah, exactly. Like, it's this amazing image of like birds building a nest, and it has this like moralistic kind of Bible-based message about, you know, making home, and you know the British workman is such a like strange and interesting ideology to kind of get into. But yeah, all about kind of building home and being industrious and stuff. But yeah, this sailor is reproducing the front page on his embroidery frame, and I was like, that's really interesting. But presumably that's the British workman kind of doing a bit of self-publicity. But actually, in kind of looking at this back and forth between the newspaper and the, you know, the kind of the people naming the seamen, it turns out that that is the work that he was making. And yeah, it gets crazier because then as I was researching him, I found his descendants and made contact with them, and I found that they still have three of his wool works, including the one I know, including the one that he is embroidering in the British Workman frontispiece.
Oh my god, you are living the archival dream. That is incredible.
It's great. And I've since visited them and seen the wool works, and other wool works that he's done are like similarly kind of collaged from different illustrations that he's like used and kind of reinterpreted. So yeah, I mean, not only is it, you know, has been a really satisfying research process, but you know, the family have been just so lovely, and you know, have been really happy themselves with learning about him and learning about the embroideries. And like, yeah, it, you know, historical research often doesn't feel like it's personally significant to anyone but you. But actually, that, you know, that has been a hugely rewarding process.
Oh my god, people who are listening to this cannot see my body language right now, but the way I have been like moving and grooving in just utter shock and awe, like at some point I put the blanket that's on my lap like up over my head. Oh my god. Wow. Okay, so I have now produced more than 70 episodes of this podcast, many of which are interviews, and this is probably one of the best stories for, having to do with a favorite embroidered object or objects I've ever heard. It has everything. It has everything. It has like, it has a meta aspect with like the newspaper, but he's actually making it. It has a named maker. It has a family connection, and it has surviving objects. My eyebrows maybe have never been higher. My brows are like at my hairline. Thank you for that. This will stick with me for a genuinely very long time. Wow.
Oh, thank you. Yeah, it's been an amazing process.
What do you think the role of needlework is in today's world?
Yeah, I mean, it's such a big question.
Yeah, sorry.
It's a really good question. I think what I can, yeah, if it's not kind of cheating a little bit, is speak to how I have conceived the kind of contemporary relevance of my work on, you know, 19th century sailors.
Yes, I
want to
hear it.
Yeah, and part of that has been, you know, thinking about sustainability, and I was part of and working with the Secondhand Cultures Group at Cardiff University for a while, and we were looking at, you know, part of the thing that we were looking at is how historical forms of secondhand economies, second, like, you know, repair, reuse, all of that stuff can inform kind of our practice today, and you know, the way we're conceiving of using and preserving and caring for our belongings in the future. So thinking, and you know, sailors are great for that because by necessity they had to be super, super thrifty. You know, it's not yes. that they're doing it for any ideological reasons, although sailors' kind of thriftiness and craftiness does get involved in the kind of self-help ideology of the later 19th century. But, you know, aside from that, they are doing it through pure necessity. You know, they often don't get the opportunity to go to shops because they're at sea for long periods of time. The amount of materials on ships are limited. So they have to be like super, super duper creative in how they're using things. So, you know, clothes get remade into bags, get remade into, you know, pillowcases, get remade into everything. So they're like, you know, a piece of material will have several lives as different objects. And so, yeah, they're kind of thrifty in that sense, but they also kind of have this like making and mending time, albeit kind of given to them by the Navy. But, you know, that they devote time to it, I think, is another interesting aspect. But then also the kind of social and emotional repair aspect that I think one of the things you see with sailors is that craft, you know, not just repair, but craft in general plays a important social role on ships. So for the kind of community afloat, that making together kind of bartering skills. So like, if you knot and put up my hammock, you can have a piece of cake, or, you know, I'll do your washing up for a week if you will mend my trousers for me, which you see a lot in like kind of textual records. So yeah, thinking about craft as a kind of cohesive force, I think has kind of interesting potential for the current moment. But also, I suppose attached to that is ideas of well-being. So, you know, we have some really good records where men are quite open about talking about craft as almost a kind of therapy. Like, they don't use the word therapy, but they're talking about like emotional distress and making, like they call it hand labor sometimes, as a means of alleviating it and working through it. So I think that that's important. You know, I'm certainly not the first person to suggest that sewing or like craft and creativity have, you know, an impact on your emotional well-being. And also I think it's important to recognize that they're not always positive emotions when you're making. Like, I mean, if my own kind of sewing is anything to go by, that often it's like frustration or anger, or, you know, just kind of ambivalence. But yeah, that craft and making has an emotional component, I think. And then kind of continuing the theme of emotion, I think one of the other places that I'm really trying to go with my research is that, you know, we often don't think about men as emotional agents. You know, we don't think about them kind of exploring, articulating, regulating their own emotions kind of freely, but also we don't associate them with like building and making a real effort to maintain emotional relationships. But in terms of sailor craft, that's something that you totally do see, that you know, they're being really reflective on their craft practice in terms of emotions, but also through the kind of activities that we associate with female makers, things like gifting practices, you know, intergenerational or like family relationship making practices and teaching practices, you know, they are totally engaging in that. And yeah, I think it's important that we think about the kind of, or that we use examples like that to disrupt gendered expectations of men.
Yeah. Oh, what a good way to conclude a very nice answer. I have nothing else to add. Yeah, I agree. Yes, 100%. Okay. Before I get to the last question, is there anything that I haven't asked about that you haven't gotten a chance to talk about? You have covered, admittedly, a lot of ground. Very impressive.
Yeah, I think I've done everything.
Okay, excellent. Then I will ask the last question. So, do you have anything you would like to promote? I think the answer is yes.
Yeah, I mean, I would love for people to come and see the Naval Fashion Display and, you know, explore the kind of wider rehang of the Queen's House. Like, I certainly can't take all the credit. My colleagues in the art curatorial department have been, you know, have done an amazing job. Also, what else can I promote? There's like an old article of mine in the 19th century gender studies journal, although it's a few years old. And then next year I have a chapter coming out in an edited collection with Bloomsbury called Objects of Poverty, so keep an eye out for that.
Fun.
And in fact, that's where the British Workman image and wool works will feature.
I will be like ordering every copy. So that is, I continue to be absolutely obsessed. Excellent. Thank you. I truly cannot wait to see the rehang at the Queen's House. I've never been. I walk by it when I am in Greenwich and I'm like, that's so beautiful. I have said out loud, that's so beautiful. But I think also the inside will be beautiful and therefore I look forward to that.
Yes. Oh yeah. Also the thing that we have at the Queen's House at the moment is, the Solbay tapestry. So Britain's the only naval tapestry to be woven in England, commissioned by Charles II and James Duke of York, later James II. We have one of 12, series of 12, 11, 12. And it was conserved the year before last. To go into the exhibition that's just come down, but we've managed to extend its display time and it's on for another year. And so, yeah, absolute, completely once in a generation opportunity to see that tapestry, which is, you know, a really, really incredible thing.
I am on my way. I am going. Okay, yeah, I'm sold. Let's go. Awesome. Love it. Maya, thank you so much. This has been truly such a delight, such a treat. You've given me a lot to think about as well. So thank you.
Hello, I am back. I learned so much from Maya during our chat and am really grateful that she took the time to talk with me. She gave me a lot to think about. There are so many connections between textiles and the sea, and it was really exciting to explore that more in depth. The sea represents so much. There's travel, connection, power, migration, and material access. That's just the tip of the iceberg. Sea pun for you all. When it comes to embroidery, it's the means by which motifs, materials, imagery, ideas, and even educators traveled the world. It's how nutmegs went from the Banda Islands to England, where they got embroidered upon. And it's how educators moved from Spain to Mexico with Italian and German pattern books in their hands and in their heads. And as mentioned in this episode, the sea is also a space where power is gained and lost, where men embroider ships that were tools of subjugation, violence, and empire. Their lengthy satin stitches echo the journeys of people, goods, ideas, and materials around the world. That's a very vague conclusion, a very summary-y conclusion to this episode, but how can you not be kind of grand and sweeping when dealing with the substance that covers 70% of the Earth's surface? It's a big, broad conclusion for the big, broad sea. And with that, I will bid you adieu. Thank you so much for listening, and if you like the podcast, whether it's your first time listening, thank you, or your 70th, thank you, please tell a pal about the pod and give us a rating and review on your favorite podcast app if you feel so inclined. We'll be back with more episodes very, very soon. Now go out and stitch some stories and give your fiancé a giant woolwork picture of a ship for her birthday. Bye!